Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the smoothest glass of cream liqueur by Amarula. We hoping for that sponsorship. For your mind, that being two crickets and a thorn tree, I'm half of your hosts, Nicholas Lorimer, joined as ever by the other half of your hosts,
Gabriel Krauser.
Well, it's been an interesting week, I think, in some ways. Yesterday, we went to the funeral of a great and glorious colleague who had an amazing life and who will be sorely missed, who is already sorely missed, and that was John Kane Berman. And it was, I thought it was a great service, and I'm sure you agree with me. It was relatively short, but really punchy, really good, and some really nice singing and a good speech.
Yeah, was one tribute, Paul Gabriel Pereira, who had been at the Institute with John Kane Berman, under John Kane.
I think it was there from 91 to 97, something like that.
Something like that. Maybe a little bit longer, but something like that. And
but he knew, I mean, he knew John very well, even when he wasn't working at the Institute. I think they cooperated quite a lot on a lot of things.
And I think he spoke beautifully. The service was very traditional.
Outside of traditional high Anglican.
Yeah, it was all liturgies and hymns and prayers. There really was, no one is making anything up on the day, right? It was this is the way that it's done kind of stuff. And I think one of the interesting points there was that JKB used to go to church most Sundays at 7 a.m. And I actually saw him once, either before or after, either on his way to church or on his way from church, back when we used to have an office. I had a bender on the Saturday night, and so I hadn't quite made it home.
So is this man of God coming along just as you're coming back from your debaucherous sin?
I was like trundling. I managed to find my sunglasses. I was like walking home from this place where I hadn't really gone to sleep at all. And like hoping that my car was still parked at the Institute's like garage. And there was JKB pulling in to sort of collect the Sunday Times. And I saw him there. And he was, you know, he was,
good morning.
He was so, his spine was so stiff. He was so erect and proper and fit and vivacious, you know. I don't know, he was he really seemed like much more alive than I felt at that time, and I think that his passing sort of came quite quickly, and someone that knew him quite well sort of described his he went to hospital, and then a few weeks later he died. The sort of intervening time, you know, things I think deteriorated very quickly, and he sort of described JKB as almost being irritated by how drawn out this process was. He was like, this is not going well. Really, really got better things to do than drag out this painful thing. Just get on with it. And there's something about being terse. I think JKB was terse. And even his death was somehow terse and proper and final, and this is the way and it just turns out that if you live like that, it doesn't reduce the amount of love and warmth and creativity in your vicinity. It sort of augments it. I mean, there was, that church was so full. I was in the corner, people were standing outside queuing down because they really had a warm attitude to this guy who had done so much good.
And the people who couldn't make it were very sad that they couldn't make it, including a Prince Mangosuthu Buthelezi, who actually sent his apologies along formally. I would have thought that would have been quite, because he's a, you know, whatever you may think of him, he's an interesting character.
And I think he's an amazing dude.
But he's very old now. He's like 94, so I'm not terribly surprised that he had some health issues which got in the way of it. He's also apparently diabetic, and according to someone told me that apparently he controls it entirely through diet. He doesn't take insulin. which
the Zulu way.
Yeah, if you oh boy, like apparently creating a menu for Buthelezi is crazy because you have to like say, okay, 75 grams of this and 400 grams of this, and ooh. But anyway, yeah, it was a great service, and it was also kind of, it felt like the sort of, you know, liberal family was there, and a couple of people who I think clashed with JKB over the years but still showed up, the ones who I think have some honor and proper respect, showed up to give his give their condolences as well, because they recognized that, you know, this is a great man, regardless of what you may have thought of him, he was definitely great, and yeah, we shall miss him very much. So I actually wish I knew him better. I didn't take advantage of my opportunity at the Institute to get to know him better. I must admit, I feared JKB in a way that I don't often fear people, because he was, because of that shortness and abruptness, you know, I never wanted to give the impression that I was wasting his time.
I'm so glad that I gave him a couple of pieces of mine to edit before, you know, I sort of said, you know, someone told me that, you know, this is an area that you're quite expert on, because it was the most merciless. What is the word for when a scientist kind of kills an animal and then cuts it open and then pulls dissection. Out its organs?
Merciless dissection. Wow.
It really, dissection somehow doesn't even sound right, because I feel like when people say dissection, they don't mean dissection. I mean
evisceration.
I mean, but clinical. There really wasn't a paragraph that hadn't been struck through someplace or another. And I was I really was hurt. You know, I was quite irritated myself. I thought, this guy, what is he? This is not right. But then he sort of was right, actually, about quite a lot of things. And it hurt my brain.
That was basically the point made in Jeremy Gordon's tribute to him, was, you know, he basically said, oh, here's my brief encounter with JKB during careers. You know, I was at the Financial Mail just as he was leaving, and the gossip amongst the lefty journalists was this was a great triumph that he was leaving because he was too right wing and now he was being replaced by a good, honest lefty. This is when he's leaving the Financial Mail to go and run the Institute of Race Relations. And Jeremy Gordon basically ends off by saying, you know, you were against the illiberal impulses of the NAT successors. And man, were you right about that. Like, you were so right about that. They weren't just illiberal impulses. They were downright scary. And it was a piece saying, dude, you got a lot of hate for it, but you were totally right.
Yeah. Yeah. And it wasn't easy to hear. And that's the way to do it. As he said, my only weapons were my words, but he wielded them well. I really do. I really like how he ends his autobiography. So when I joined the Institute, the first thing that I did was I read Franz Kronier's Time Traveler's Guide to 2030. And then in the second week, I read John Kane Berman's Between Two Fires, his autobiography. And I think that was a good way in to getting to know him a little bit. I also very much regret that I didn't get to know more. But it did. He wrote about himself candidly. Wasn't so terse as to cut out the humanity. He allowed himself a little bit of an anecdote about his, you know, the sweetness, sweeter parts of his youth, before getting into the, you know, the legacy of his parents, both of whom were potent liberals. In the Torch Commando, that amazing
an organization which is basically not in the syllabus for South Africa's high school history education, which I think is a great stain. But anyway,
yeah. But those guys, I mean, those guys fought the. You know, you ask yourself when instead of adding to the voters' roll, colored people were removed from the voters' roll. like, what were you doing? Well, those guys were in the streets, you know, carrying their torches, saying hell no.
Even better, they had just come back from fighting the fascists in Europe. Yeah. Now they came back. They came back to South Africa to fight the fascists here. Unfortunately, they didn't win.
They didn't win. It is a
noble. They did at least
fight. It is a noble thing. And he was born into that. You know, his dad's house was, his parents' house was probably burnt down, by Nats, trying to send a message to the Torch Commando. When he was a kid. And at his funeral, his brother recounted how they would have dinner every night, the family around the table, the four boys and the parents, sort of his father in a suit, his mother in an evening dress, evening gown, and the four boys all in jacket and tie. and they would talk about politics. And Jake, it's like JKB never quite took off his tie. And I think that did make him difficult. But it also, there was just something about standing up straight and doing the proper correct thing, even if people want to burn down your house.
yes,
because humans are humans, and oppressing people because of their race is just inhuman, and it's improper. Yes. It's bad manners. You know, somehow there's like a view on the world where like the real issue with racism is it's very bad manners, and you mustn't. And it's a very powerful idea, actually, and I think that
it is. Yes.
Can I read that poem? Sorry.
Yeah. In a second, I want to tell one more story about the whole thing from my side, which is, you know, when someone attractive compliments you and gives you a big ego boost, you're like, oh, this is great. Well, I had the intellectual version of that when Pierre, who was JKP's partner, said to me, he did like some of your stuff. In fact, I remember him saying relatively recently, Lorimer wrote a good article. And that was about as high as JKB's praise ever got. But when I heard that, I felt all warm and mushy inside. And, dude,
man. I think the strongest, when I gave that Liberal Club speech at the black tie thing after Helen Ziller, and JKB came and said, I wrote it down somewhere. I think it was something to the effect, astonishing. Astonishing. You mustn't stop.
And it'll stay with you forever.
And I was just, man.
Go ahead, read the poem.
So this is written by Jan Saliers. Oddly enough, I went to law school, Jan Saliers. As a grade four, my own little experience of being the other, getting beaten about the ears for being an English boy because I didn't speak in Afrikaans. But then I learned and I made friends and we all came out much better for it, I think. Anyway, I haven't heard this poem, I think, almost since I was in primary school. I think the one exception, oddly enough, was our former quiz master and a colleague at the Institute, Deval Hutting, once referred me to it in my mid-20s at an interesting juncture, but it was concluded wonderfully in Paul's remarks on John's life. And it's just the first, it's a wonderful little bit. Stil broers, daar gaan 'n man verby. Hy groet en dis verlaas. Daar's nog maar een soos hy. Bekyk hom goed. And for those who would benefit from a translation, although it's difficult to pull everything across the language boundary, it means something roughly like, quiet brothers, there goes a man. He greets and then it's over or abandoned. There's just one. There's all but one like him. Behold him well. think that liberalism is about individuals being the core, the kernels, the core values of society. And it's good to behold someone who has made a life, an individual life, into something great. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. All right. I mean, it's difficult to follow that up.
It is,
and I vaguely as important.
We will probably hopefully find a way to I think get a little bit more into the subject of John Kenbaum's life at another stage and in another way, maybe with someone who
you know. And there will also on the Daily Friend podcast be a special edition with the two CEOs who came after John, talking about his life and stuff, and I'm sure that'll be great as well. But that's still a ways away. They wanted some time to sort of consider and reflect what exactly they were going to say before we did that episode. That'll come down the pike.
Down the pike, the American turnpike is a highway where there's the highway goes under the highway. I just want to say, like, as a more general thing, part of what's interesting about reflecting on a person like JKB's life is that there are those who whose names are in the headlines, who change the course of events. And then there are those who don't catch as much limelight, but who really make important changes at important moments. And lobbyist is a sort of dirty word in many contexts.
I think often unfairly so, because, you know, at the end of the day, democracy is literally supposed to involve lobbying. But yeah, that's a discussion I think for another time, in a sense.
Exactly. So I mean, I think we can get part of what I think is interesting about talking about an individual like his life is that you can hardly do it without pushing into terrain that people that is so unmainstream, and in a way that is both reflective or indicative of interesting things about our time in history, and why it is that in our time of history, with all the information around, it still turns out to be the case that that esteem is sort of distributed in the way that it is, where the characters that are well known and admired and that serve as role models are often of a sort, in a way, and those who really sort of exercise influence in a way that is more reason responsive and more sensitive to common interest rather than partisan interest or political power grabs, narrowly conceived. Why that kind of chap, which I think fits the mold of what a teenager, you know, if you ask the average teenager, you know, of course you might want to get into sports or you might want to get into inventing things, curing cancer. There are all kinds of, you know, going to the moon. There are all kinds of jobs you might want to get into. If you get into politics, what kind of politician would you like to be? I think most teenagers would probably say, well, I wouldn't want to be the one who's always chasing after the camera. I wouldn't be the one who's trying to sort of hug the babies to seem cool while just doing whatever the rich people tell me to do. I'd want to be the guy who's going out there and arguing against all of the political parties in the mainstream for the really good idea that's missing from the conversation.
And the ones who would want to do that, who do desire to do something like that, would never admit to it. Because it's so demeaning. It's like saying, I want to be the kind of person who becomes really famous in movies by manipulating the studio system and sleeping with everyone I need to get to the top.
No one's saying that. Right. So
no one admits to planning that.
Everyone's got this kind of granola, idea of like of what the good guy does should be doing, the good person should be doing. Yes. But then there are actually good people, and their stories don't necessarily get out all that far. And I think that's an interesting thing, both about our time, but it's also universal. And it is also somehow a reflection about the actual fact that some people are not in the business of trying to maximize the amount of money they have or trying to maximize the amount of name brand recognition that they have. When I was a kid, people used to, I remember one of the sort of like sort of philosophical questions that I could understand in primary school that grown-ups would ask, and sometimes we would ask each other, there's a sort of like party, you know, sort of at break time. It's like, would you rather come up with a line that or an invention or something that everyone knows or uses or rehearses, but your name is not attached to it, or but it's really, really useful and it's amazing, or come up with something where your name remains attached to it, but it's not that great? And it is, I mean, it's a good question, because as I remember the primary school conversation, some people said, no, dude, I want my name to be stuck there. Like if I'm going to do it. And some people What's are not point? Like that. They just like, mm-hmm. That's really not the point. The point is to try it. And I think it's those stories where people are quite private persons, as JKB was, for, you know, where it actually takes your effort to get in there, to pull out some of the details, that those can be really worthwhile stories to dwell on.
Mm-hmm, indeed.
But so more of that to come. In the meantime, let's talk about South Africa.
For some reason, I don't know why, but when you said, would you rather, immediately my mind went to fight 100 duck-sized ducks? Horses, or one horse-sized duck. Which is a classic of would you rathers. And I think the answer is obviously the small horses, because ducks are scary, man.
Dude, I got plucked by a goose when I was 7, and I still
geese are evil.
Dude, and geese are much worse than ducks, but I think if a duck was the size of a horse, it'd be a lot like a goose.
You know, like So science has relatively recently discovered that, you know, or confirmed with 100% surety that birds are exactly, they're the same family as dinosaurs. In fact, that when they talk about the extinct dinosaurs, they call them the non-avian dinosaurs, because they really are the same thing. And you know what? If you look at the eyes of a chicken or some of these nasty ones, you could see the T-Rex in there.
Yes, dude. If human beings were, if the size ratio between a human and a chicken was reversed,
we'd have some real problems.
Yeah, not both of those species would be on the planet. Like, I don't think it would be one. How environmentally friendly you are, there is no ways that, like, if there were only 5 of them left in the world, we would still kill every last one of them. Like,
precisely. So as way of a segue from that completely irrelevant tangent, have you noticed, is it just me? So here's a question, right? There's the news recently has been filled with, I think I made a comment on the show like a year or two ago about how big crime doesn't seem to like really make the news in a super shocking way. Or at least if it does, it's very sort of over by the next day. You know, no one seems to look into it. And all of a sudden that seems to have changed. And we've had, I think, at least a couple of months worth of focus on some of the really awful crimes that are going on in South Africa. So my first question to you is this simply a feature of the media suddenly deciding, you know, this is the flavor of the moment and this is the issue we're going to talk about? Or is it actually getting more crazy and more hairy out there in terms of the sort of violence that people are subjected to on a daily basis?
As a kid, I used to sometimes fantasize that I could nudge the news. I was like a lonely single child, effectively. I've got a sister, which was not. And one of the thoughts is like, you know, like me and my imaginary friends would like send in a little thing and you just like, you cut the clip shorter or you like, you add something and send secret messages. And I suppose because of that, I started coming up with slightly fruity ideas about how the news works from when I was like in grade four or something. Then I think one of the good things about that is you come up with theories and then time dispels the ones that are obviously mad. And the ones that kind of end up sticking around at least have that to say for them. So one of the ones that stuck around for the longest and that still sticks in my mind, although I've got no better evidence for it than what I've sort of laid out, is the thought that when the race card is really not in the winning sort of suit, or you know, if there's like four kinds of, you know, diamonds clubs and you're playing bridge and one of them is now the trumping suit, and the other, some other one is like the weakest, when race is in its weakest footing is an issue in the media space for whatever reason, then crime gets much more coverage. And another way to put it is that, you know, there's a lot to be said for the Oscar Pistorius murder case. And there's a lot to be said about those murder cases in the hotel in Stellenbosch, where some guy probably axed his wife to death and so on. And the other one where some guy killed his whole family and shot his, but his sister survived and the shooting, and so can testify against the brother who killed everyone else in the family. Like the Davel Stuck murders where like serial killers were eating people. There are these amazing, horrific incidents where white people are the perpetrators and they absolutely deserve attention. But I often get the feeling that they get more attention than they would have gotten if the perpetrators were black. Not because of anything other than this, the desire on the part of producers and editors to say, look, white people also commit crime. And I've often felt that to be a salutary thing, especially when I was a kid in the, you know, as an 8-year-old in the 90s, it seemed I knew enough old people who would say that black people are criminals. It was certainly not acceptable kind of behavior in the household, but you know, when one goes out, one hears these things, and I could understand why one would have a good reason to emphasize white criminals in order to dispel that kind of stupid thinking. But then as time goes by, you sort of sit with these awful crime statistics, and it's an embarrassment for the ANC. It's also an embarrassment for the national project of a rainbow, you know, for the rainbow project, because we've, you know, 500,000 people have been murdered since 1994. At this stage, it's pushing on 600,000. That really is a much higher death. You know, that's worse than Afghanistan. That's worse than Iraq. That's, you know, that is a major war. You think what's happening in Ukraine is terrible. 500,000 people have been murdered in this country in the last 25 years at a rate that is almost out of this world. So it's a huge stain on the change. And before the change, South Africa was a police state, and they were like Inyalas and Caspers and whatever riding around everywhere enforcing the law. And it was a really, really bad law. And especially from the late 80s, enforcement started to cave in, and the People's War, 20,000, 25,000 black people were killed, almost entirely black people were killed. I'm saying the meme, the irritating meme is this thought that like, well, apartheid, whatever you say about it, at least the Oaks enforced the law. And now comes this thing and everyone's being killed left, right, and center. And and I understood that. I mean, I watched this play by a playwright called Mark von Kron, Green Man Flashing, in 2006. I was in grade 10. at the Grahamstown Arts Festival. And it sort of interwove, was it Green Man Flashing? It might have been a different play. Anyway, it interwove scenes from that he'd basically taken, lifted from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of police torturing someone, a kind of sexual torture with the hose pipe, and then leading to death of a white cops torturing a black guy who was a political, who was a communist, their version of a communist, which meant someone who believed that everyone, every adult deserves to vote. Unfortunately, communism remains very poorly defined. It's always been a problem in this country. Anyway, they were interspersing these scenes with the play interspersed those scenes with a contemporary rape scene that leads to death. And there were obvious analogies because from the point of view of the victim, you know, there's a sexual violation and it's followed by a murder. And I remember actually talking about that play to Rian Malan, and he said, but this is a crazy comparison because in the case of a rape today, at least you can take your complaint to the police and you should be taken seriously. And the law, at least in theory, is supposed to hunt down the perpetrator. Whereas in that instance, the law was not at all supposed to hunt down the perpetrator, which I thought was a good way of trying to draw some kind of difference between the horrors of apartheid and the horrors of ordinary crime, is that apartheid legitimized crime. You know, the law was the crime. And there is something especially bad about that. But this is all to say, crime is a very difficult thing for us to process because it is so easy to start using high crime rates as some kind of retrospective justification for apartheid. That is a temptation that is irrational and stupid, but it's emotionally appealing, and human monkeys like me and you are run, unfortunately, mostly by emotional temptation and not by reason. And so the better the patronizing taste-making elites, the producers and the editors, they're like, okay, this is very scary. We don't want to talk about crime because that's going to sound like it's going to translate in someone's head into some celebration of white supremacy.
Right.
So that's the sort of background justification for the claim that the alternative way to think about it is when we're all actually just being sober and smart. It's like, dude, if a child is stealing from a spaza shop, it's not to do with race. If a child is stealing from a Woolies, it's not to do with race. It's to do with not understanding that you need to stick to the rules. And if someone is hurting someone else, it's bad because you're hurting someone. So, you know, we need law and order, and we need to not be distracted by the stupid ways that people will try and interpret calls for law and order with reference to history. It's just something we need now. We all need to be safe now. It's the first of Maslow's needs, is you need to be safe from attack. And so when South Africa's in a when South Africa's media space is in a pragmatic vein, I think it tends to give more time to crime, and without sort of trying to cherry pick cases based on race, it's just going for the cases that are the scariest, the cases that are the most resonant. And this week we started with Tembisa, four people dead in those riots. I think two of them involved in the bombing of ATM machines, two of them probably shot by the Ekurhuleni Metro Police Department. 31 vehicles burnt down, the municipal offices burnt. Yeah. Burnt.
I think a police station might also have been attacked as well.
It was wild. I mean, and look, it's not like race was not involved in that story at all. Even after two people were reported dead, I saw ENCA. I filmed 15 minutes of ENCA on that Monday. It was so mad. They found some community member who's like, they're like, what about the deaths? What about like the, he was like, yeah, but you know, the thing that hurts me the most is that the mayor is a white woman. And so obviously she doesn't feel our pain. Like what an inhuman response. Dude, and then it was carried over when Sally Bird, when the anchor asked the correspondent, she had to ask him multiple times, what about the deaths? Because every time he's like, the first time he's like, what about the deaths? He's like, just hold on, I'll get to that. But can you just look, the camera's like focusing. You see there's a little bit of like a bust water pipe or sewage pipe. There's some water coming out here. And here there's a lady standing on a rock and she's talking about this and that, about how the mayor didn't come to see them on Friday, but she might come to see them on Monday. But, oh, we can't wait for that. What a, like, okay, thank you. Literally 8 minutes of that. And then it's like, okay, back to the question. What about the deaths? And then he pivoted again. Like death, blood, life is so cheap, unfortunately, in South Africa, that it's actually 500,000 people have been murdered. It's hard to draw attention.
It's also a great example of people like using race as a way to kind of like change the conversation away from something they might to something they want to talk about away from something they don't want to talk about. In this case, you know, why is this thing turned into a riot that's destroyed municipal property and, you know, led to some deaths? Well, okay, you know, but the real problem is the white mayor.
Yeah, it's a total pivot. It's a transparent and total pivot. But so part of the story is that I think South Africa is, you know, Ipsos has been doing these surveys. How do you think the country is going in the right or the wrong direction? And South Africa, on average, over the last 5 years, is the worst in the world. About, on average, 90% of people think we're going in the wrong direction. Right. In the first quarter of 2018, that number dropped 15%. So almost a third of South Africans in the New Dawn thought we were going in the right direction, according to the Ipsos poll. But the numbers came right back down to only 8% think we're going in the right direction. Most people think we're going in the wrong direction. We asked, our own survey last year asked, has your life improved in the last 5 years? Since Ramaphosa came to power, has your life gotten any better? I think just around 20% said yes. 80% said it's either the same or it's worse. So like on Thursday, after JKB's funeral, I went to ENCA to be part of a panel. I mean, it was amazing. Kenneth Brown was like former chief procurement officer for SARS, for the country, you know, for country in a way, for treasury, sorry. Bohang Mokgale, Bonang Mokgale, Professor Bonang Mokgale, the chancellor of, vice chancellor of, the head of Free State University. Someone from COSATU who I can't remember, but she said, but just as an aside, she said in the 90s, the great thing was in the build up to the revolution, all the black parties were together. They were unified.
yes. We must
bring that back.
That's either the gross ignorance or a, shall we say, selective reading of history.
Yes, dude. The IFP and the ANC were unified. I mean, that woman, I really wanted to.
Well, you could interpret it to say that in her mind, the IFP are not black.
Oh, right. Yeah. Also, but I don't. Anyway, I like that. But also, there was Nhlanhla Lux there, the sort of head of the militia drive foreigners out. So we went to People's Party.
Well, you know, he's split from Operation Dudula now.
Yeah, I know. They've got different ways of trying to.
Interestingly, he basically said, no, I'm only against the illegal foreigners, whereas Operation Dudula apparently said, no. We don't want any foreigners here. If you don't have SA, born in SA on your passport, on your ID, you must get out.
Wow. And dude, he was, his charisma, and the only other time I felt, there's a couple of times, the last time I felt that was when I was in a petrol station in the middle of rural KZN with Helen Ziller. Everyone in the room wanted to be with him. Everyone wanted to take a photo with him. Everyone wanted to get an anecdote out of him.
This is what makes me very worried.
Is potent, very potent, very, very attractive right now. He is, I would say he, Maimani's an interesting fellow. Mashaba's, I've been in that same studio with Mashaba. Yeah, Mashaba's an interesting guy. Dude, Lux Dlamini has got that rock star factor right now.
Which is not his real name. I can't remember what his real name is. It got revealed in a court
Nhlanhla, thing. I think. But yeah, even Nhlanhla's not his real name. Exactly.
Yeah.
Lux is his stage name, and Nhlanhla is his stage name, and then there's an original name. Dude, that guy, there were DA people there, Action SA people there, ANC people there, ANC youth and establishment people there, COSATU people there, Nelson Mandela Children's Foundation people there, journalists, you know, ENCA workers. Everybody wanted to get their selfie with Lux. When we did the big group photo, the producer wanted him in the middle. When they were talking on the screen, we had like a 90-minute thing. Everyone wanted to say yes, as he said. And the points he was making, dude, that guy, the last point, he turned to me and he's like, you know, you're so right. I got to knock BEE and no one contradicted me for an hour and a half on primetime national television. Dude, that's how angry South Africa is. It is so pragmatic and so angry that a member of the Institute of Race Relations who looks like me can just go and say a common sense thing like, we're talking about policy. How can we improve education? We should give vouchers. We should give grant vouchers to parents so that they can decide where their kids go to school. The same kind of system that's been tried in Nigeria and America, India and so on. And we asked parents, would you prefer that or more BEE? And 80% of black respondents said they prefer vouchers for education and healthcare and so on than BEE. And why is this connected? Well, because as you guys have been saying, I could quote there, Kenneth Brown, there, the DA people, there, the Soweto people's Congress people saying the big problem was we didn't professionalize the civil first service. Yes, we didn't. What did we do? We made race a criteria instead of expertise. We put skills and race as if they're in competition instead of just listening to what most South Africans say, which is getting the best place for the job. And it's fine if they're white or black or Indian or colored. And if you think it's a problem if they're black, if you think it's a problem if they're Indian, white or colored, then you're the problem. That is the much better way to go. And no one contradicted me. And instead, Lux finished his spiel, his last comment, by saying, you know, my parents tried to bring that hateful attitude of saying, white people, hana, hana, back in the day, hana, hana. I don't want to hear it. I tell them, stop. We must work with white people. We must work with black people. We must work with Indian people, colored people, all people. We have to work together. Everyone was so angry that non-racialism was sexy for a moment.
That's how you know things are bad.
Things are that bad, dude. It is that what I was trying to say about the Ipsos polling. We haven't seen the latest numbers, but I'm sure that this winter, after 2 million jobs gone, after you can see that the post-COVID recovery is not happening, with inflation, with petrol climbing, with all of the issues that we have on top of the issues that we already had, I think people are fed up with the Wits style of analysis where you have to sort of light your pipe and reflect on 35 years ago. It is, dude, on that stage, so many people were saying, I don't want to, literally, I don't want to hear your stories about apartheid. The issue is now, 28 years into democracy, you have lost your right to blame things on apartheid. We are no longer teenagers in this country. We are a mature country. When you are 28 years old, you cannot blame your parents. You have to take responsibility for your life. This was being said in a crowd full of political agents. And the thing that kept hangering, you know, one of the things that basically kept arguing for, the only thing that was subtle was the argument for vigilantism.
Yes.
And that is at the heart of the criminal activity. It is this idea of the government is so bad. It is so corrupt. It is so useless that its core function of enforcing the law against people who steal cannot be respected. They are the ones who steal. The government is the ones who steal. So we have to make our own justice. And sometimes that means bombing ATMs in order to theoretically lower the price of electricity. And sometimes it means going after the Zama Zamas. I mean, dude, as far as I can tell, guys, I saw 9 people stripped bare naked on camera, being driven through the streets, being whipped through the streets. It is medieval what happened there with those Zama Zamas. It is positively, it's flabbergasting that it still happens.
There's a creepy sort of xenophobia angle to it as well, which is that, you know, a lot of the Zama Zamas are Basutus, or at least that's the reputation they have. And so this is sort of, you see, we need to drive these foreign dogs out and punish them and whip them in the streets. This is also, so, you know, some people, they hear like, oh, the state's failing in its thing and people are taking responsibility. And there's definitely some good sides to that. But at the same time, yes,
watering your own garden is wonderful.
Right, right. We're not going to get a sort of you know, hyper individualistic federal liberal libertarian paradise if the state crumbles in its duty to protect law and order. We're going to get warlordism.
Dude, and warlordism is
nasty.
It's so ugly, dude. The bizarre thing about this ENCA debate that I went to was that it sounded to me exactly like conversations we were part of in 2019, where we were making the same points, where people who misdescribe themselves as libertarians or whatever, you know, where a kind of some ethnocentrists who just want a lager mentality so that the folk can unite, and some libertarians who kind of think all government is bad and so all self-help is good, were neglecting to consider the essential and indispensable role of government, which is to maintain law and order under the rule of law if it's doing it properly. And it was exactly the same. The Soweto People's Congress, it's the same, dude. And warlordism, it's exactly this.
My dad sent me an interesting article recently about Mexico and the way that the Mexican state is beginning to disintegrate.
Mm.
Those drug cartels have gone beyond being drug cartels at this point. The big ones in the north, the Sinolas and all these other groups. And recently there was a case where El Chapo, who is the big famous drug lord who got arrested and is in jail in the US now, and then escaped at one point and got recaptured.
He escaped, yeah.
Yeah, and then they got him back. But anyway, he's still very influential. His sons are very big in one of the cartels down there. And these cartels are now expanded into everything. They're essentially becoming shadow governments. They don't just run drugs. They control the avocado harvest. They police, you know, some local municipal functions. They do all these things. They have their own armed forces, essentially. The Mexican army arrested two of El Chapo's sons. One of them escaped and then took over a regional capital's city center and fought like a military style engagement with the Mexican army, and at the same time dispatched hit squads to go and kill the families of the soldiers he was fighting against, until the second brother was eventually ordered by the Mexican president to be released. And what's happening across a lot of Mexico is that essentially warlordism is becoming the fact of life. You've got cartels controlling some parts of the country. You've got regional governors controlling like some part. And then you've also got, people who are, you know, what we might call sort of self-defense units, people who are so scared of being traumatized and abused by the cartels and the government that they're arming themselves and taking the law into their own hands and defending their communities with weapons. Now that's admirable in the short term, but in the long term, they're going to become warlords just like everyone else.
You're just another mafia. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Because, you know, like suddenly, okay, well, this guy, you know, he's not really playing by the rules, so we're going to go and sort him out. And then the local community asks you to deal with this problem. And before you know it, you're this parallel government.
And you have to spend all your time doing it, so you're not making money. And community people are like, oh, dude, have some money. We're so grateful for your help.
Here's some donations.
Yeah, and then donations eventually become rent and taxes. Extortion. Right. Yeah, exactly.
Right. And so, you know, we already actually have examples of warlordism in this country. Most of them are in KZN. And, you know, look to KZN to see the future if this trend continues. Because it is not pretty. It is negative for growth and livelihoods, because, you know, when you don't have the liberal structure of society like the courts and like a constitutional system, when force and patronage and appealing to the local strongman are what's are the ways to get ahead, people don't build businesses, they don't create produce, they don't develop anything except what the warlord says that they can develop. And it's not just, you know, there's a temptation of that same sort of recalcitrant, like angry, bitter sort of white nationalist to say, you know, this is only a problem for black people. No. I have met people in white suburbs who are proto-warlords. They often run security companies, or they run some sort of local vigilante, sort of semi-vigilante community forum or something like that.
Mm.
And I guarantee you that as the state continues to retreat, those people are going to start exercising a lot of influence that no legal, no constitutional authority gives them. And in fact, in some cases already do. Right.
Yeah.
You know, people, that might, the there's a phrase in sort of South African parlance that always makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable is when the way that community and community leader are thrown about.
Hey, it is harsh, hey? It is so, yes. It's so naked. It's such a, this guy that I said who said the problem in Tembisa where 4 people died, the thing that hurt him the most was that the mayor is white. Underneath, of course, what did it say on ENCA's banner? Community leader.
Yes. And when people talk about the community, you know, this is not, no one elected these people. No one elected this person to be in charge. No one elected these rioters to say, okay, we're going to go and burn down the local municipal office. It's it's ruled by strength, and these people are not leaders. They're opportunists, they're bullies. Or bandits. Or
yeah, bullies. They're the people that everyone else is too afraid to pull off the rock, to pull off the soapbox. I think that it's worth dwelling on the Zama Zama thing for a moment. So also included in the killings and the sort of walk of shame, this like scene right out of Game of Thrones where you make someone be naked and you walk them through the streets and you whip them while they're walking. There is also the allegation that while knowingly people were still in a mine shaft, you know, not the heavy deep one, but anyway, that it was closed by quote unquote the community. This is how it's been reported. Trapping those people underneath and causing them to sort of die a pretty excruciating death of dehydration effectively in the hot underground with no water or fresh air for a few days. It'll take a few days, but eventually they'll die. It's not clear that anyone's out there to rescue them. It's not 100% clear to me that people were definitely trapped under there or that they don't have another way out, but that is the apparent intention of those who
blocked
those shots. Yeah. Right. So it's really grim. So what the media, that there has been a lot of coverage of this. Very little of it has been about the actual, well, it turns out that you can give a lot of airtime to an issue with and leave a lot of questions unanswered. One of the most obvious questions is, what is the motivation? Why is quote unquote the community so angry at the Zama Zamas that they're sort of keen to strip them naked and kill them and so on, trap them underground? And insofar as that question gets any attention, the answer is a simple reference to the fact that the Zama Zamas are themselves a gang, that they have terrorized the communities, and that you know, you can sort of understand it basically on that basis. Now, here's my problem with that interpretation. I don't know much, but what I do know about gang warfare or gangs is that they're not the kinds of things that get taken on by quote unquote the community. If it was true that the community is the kind of thing that'll stand up and strip gangsters down naked and march them through the streets while whipping them, then the Cape Flats would have had at this stage, so many people being marched naked through the streets that
fair, it did have some. You remember, it was before our time, but I'm sure you know of what are they called? Pachad, sort of,
yes.
Yeah.
People against guns and drugs. This is exactly, yes.
Right. So those people existed and they did a whole bunch of that to drug dealers. And then they sort of, they went a bit far in some places. And they became something not so good.
Well, firstly, some of them went a bit dead and some of them went too far. But it was, one of the things that stood out about Pachad was that it was organized, that it had a name. And another thing that stood out was that it had a very potent religious point of call. The idea that a community in South America, where does the community get up and go take out hardened gangsters? The whole point of hardened gangsters is that they're very hard to take out. Like, how come those guys didn't have any guns? Like, before you stripped them naked, did you take their gun off of them without getting shot? What kind of gangsters are these? I strongly suspect on the face of it, when I see nine men being marched naked down the street, that they were not gangsters in the first place. That no one who's whipping them and marching down the street is worried that that guy's going to go to jail for whatever you can possibly criminalize him for, maybe for a weekend. And he's then going to come out and find his gun wherever he buried it or buy a new one and shoot you through the head as you sleep. Like, I just didn't see any of that worry. So I suspect that they weren't gangsters. And this is not to say that I don't think any of the Zamazamas are gangsters. And it's not even to say that I doubt that some of those guys weren't tough and rough. The kind of chap where at a pool bar, a kind of Shabin, if you come on the wrong side of one of them, they
he locks so eyes hard. With you. You're going to want to start running because he's going to mess you up.
They're tough. And like, if you cheat him at pool, he will probably beat you up. Like, I'm sure those Zamazamas, I'm very confident that they're tough guys. That they're hard men. But the thought that they're organized gangsters who are going around extorting the community for money, threatening them with violence, you know, I'll burn down your Shabin unless you give me free drinks. I'll kill your daughter unless you sleep with me. Like, I'm inventing these specific allegations to try and make sense of a story that has not been explored whatsoever in the media. The media just says they're terrorizing the community. I find it difficult to believe that the community, whatever that is, would be able to overwhelm an organized gang in the fashion that it did, and that it would do so in the kind of humiliating way that it did, without being able to assure that it then concluded the humiliation with killing them or putting them in jail for a sufficiently long time that they'd feel safe thereafter. So I suspect that this is just a typical case of the strong preying on the relatively weak. I suspect that part of the issue is that they are illegal, that part of the issue is that they are foreign for the most part, that they're a stigmatized group, that they're kind of just hardy enough to sort of survive in the usual course of things. I know from living in Yeovil when I have what it's like to walk around with your chest puffed out and looking over both your shoulders most of the time, sort of being aware of where people are around you so that if you do get attacked, you can throw some punches and some kicks and extract yourself from the situation fairly cleanly, but not to be capable of doing much more than that, so that if you're attacked in a coordinated way by a very large group of people, then you're going to be stoned to death or you're going to do what you're told. I saw someone get stoned to death pretty much outside my mother's house. I have tried, I couldn't figure out who, why, what in a credible way. But on the allegations presented by the people who were sort of watching from the periphery, dude, that was not a hardened criminal. It was like, it starts out, he was a Tutsi. Oh, what? You know, he stole two loaves of bread and like, in someone's shoes and a cell phone. It's like, this is not, in a way, I think the gangsters are the guys doing the whipping. They're the guys sort of connected to the cops who are making sure to look away at certain times and look in at certain times. And I think that one of the strange things that's exposed by when crime does come into the forefront of the South African picture, the thing that shines out to me, as we discussed before the show, is that South Africa really is a very conservative country.
Yeah.
And the political establishment is very left-wing and very progressive and so on and so forth. And sometimes they sort of give the sense of, well, we have more enlightened views than our people because we are against the death penalty and our people are for it. But like, dude, this country is very conservative. In some ways, it's a good thing, but it's so conservative that in some ways it's a very bad thing. It's a very dangerous thing. Mm. It's like we live in a country that has all of the potential to bring out the worst sides of conservatism, the worst xenophobia, the worst kind of anarcho-libertarian, communitarian.
You know what I would say? I'd call it there's a sort of reactionary streak of, you know, the real mistake that South Africa made was giving these criminals too many rights. And I mean, what's his name? Jacob Zuma has at times tried to take advantage of this. This is one of my favorite quotes from Jacob Zuma, is when he was giving a talk to the ANC. It was relatively close to before he got, you know, that little shindig with him, sort of got arrested. When he said, you know what the real problem in this country is that the criminals have more rights than the victim.
Yeah, he did say that. Dude, you know who said that to me? I was pulled over one day. I was driving down Bears Nordier to go and play paddle at the Joburg Country Club with John Enderson and Frans Grenier, former and current CEOs of Institute of Racial Relations. And I was pulled over by the cops, and I was very irritated because I'm late, and like I don't want to be late for my boss. And I was going to be just on time. But anyway, the cop was like, dude, you're not wearing a seatbelt. Your hooter doesn't work. Your lights don't work as brightly as they should. Like, it's the morning. The brake lights, even. I don't know, whatever. It was some problem. I also didn't have a driver's license. Like, that cop had all of the reason in the world to write me a fine. And I was done. I was like, dude, just write me a fine. I need to go. Like, please don't write me a fine. I'm a poor journalist, but if you're going to write me a fine. Dude, when he found out I was a journalist, he just wanted to talk to me. And he was like, you okay, so you're a journalist. What do you, what, when you're telling the people what's wrong with the country, what do you tell?
It's like, I don't really have time. This is not a small topic. This is a big topic.
Dude, luckily
I can't give you the 5-minute Cliff Notes version.
Dude, this is not one of those guys who was asking the question because he wanted to hear the answer. He was asking the question because he wanted to give the answer. And his answer was, the problem is we give the criminals too many rights. But it's amazing because he said, you know who's the best example? That Jacob Zuma. Look how many rights he's given.
Well, this was exactly my thought. When Jacob Zuma made these comments, I said, yeah, I mean, he would know.
Yeah, dude, but this cop, I mean, we're such a conservative. What? Yeah. So here's how the conversation continues. Dude, he's got his hand on his gun in his holster. And he's looking at me and he's like, you know, you're a criminal. And if I was to shoot you now, because you have broken the law, you're not driving properly, you don't have a driver's license. If you start giving me lip if you start giving me cheek, and I'm worried that you're going to attack me, and I just shoot you now between even maybe just in the leg to stop you, but not to kill you. You know who's going to go to jail? I said, I don't know. He says, I'm going to go to jail.
Outrageous.
Can you believe it? This is why this country doesn't work.
And look, you know what? The thing is, and this is the thing I think, and this is once again a point I made in an article a while ago. This is ubiquitous to every class, race, doesn't matter how you divide the country. This is the experience that all of us have, because we are also freaking traumatized by the violence and the horror going on around us, that this impulse to say, you know what, let's just shoot them all and let God figure out who the good ones and the bad ones are.
Yeah.
It is very relatable.
Oh, dude, it does not take an active imagination to know what that feeling is.
Yes.
It's right there. It's inside. And it is inside all of us, because it is a very traumatic thing to live in South Africa.
and as to your point of conservatism, the point my father always makes with regards to this is every single political meeting in this country begins with a prayer. And I actually quite like the way that South Africans have managed to do this, because even though these prayers are often like explicitly Christian or whatever, there's also sort of a kind of a tolerance and a no ill feeling by anyone. So if someone says a Muslim prayer or a Christian prayer or Hindu prayer, other people kind of just accept it. And it's I must say, it's one thing I think South Africans have done pretty well for the most part, is our ability to tolerate different religions is pretty good, you know, considering that we always have all these kind of weird, you know, we're supposed to be a country allegedly split apart by race and very divided by class or whatever. Yeah, you know, we've got all these like social issues and clashes, but when it comes to religion, even though we've actually got quite a few in this country, yeah, it's like, yeah, whatever, you know, like it doesn't matter if we're a secular society and parliament starts with a prayer. It's like, okay, that's fine. Yeah. I mean, sometimes some commentators get a little bit annoyed by it here and there, but like, it's never really a big issue.
there's a sort of old, I must say, old white men. I do feel like it's not nice to generalize, but I do think it's fair to say that that white people had a different, generally speaking, had a different education experience than black people under apartheid, and that it is an important project of the Nats to try to, through school age, produce young men who are prepared to join the army. And some of the South African armed forces contributions in Africa were probably for the good in terms of taking out communists in Angola and whatever. I don't want to get into litigating the justness of those wars or injustices, but I think that there is room to have some kind of reasonable respect for the whole conscription thing. You know, I got one uncle who was a lieutenant in the army and another one who was a total draft dodger. And I think you can have both in one family and get along.
My family very much was on the draft dodging side there. And when they did go, they mucked about as much as they could. Yes. I mean, at one point when my dad was conscripted, he got into like the army newspaper or something, you know, because he had this journalism background, and he said, you know, we need to have a section of the office which is dedicated towards understanding the enemy. And so he managed to convince them to give him permission to set up a like stand or something filled with ANC propaganda.
Yes
And another thing he used to do is shoot other people's targets at the firing range. Which would make the sergeant so angry because he couldn't quite tell who was doing it. Anyway, so this is my father's efforts to gum up the works of the apartheid war machine.
but it's a strange.
But he, I mean, you know, the good thing about that was on a personal level, taught one how to dodge systems, which is a useful skill sometimes.
very important skill to cultivate in just about anywhere, really. But so, you know, I think that some white dudes who grew up in environments where Christianity was used as a tool to try and indoctrinate racism, have a beef against Christianity where you ask them to pray, you know, to participate
in a Christian prayer, they do won't resent it.
They resent that, but they'll participate in a Hindu or a Muslim or a Jewish. You know, if they were at a Jewish wedding and everyone bowed their head to say a little prayer, they would go mumble without feeling.
They've got a very specific beef with Christianity, and especially with the Inheer Kirk.
Yes. So, but I think outside of that, and I just say that because that does largely because that defines an important part of the sort of society that I have moved through. And I have sometimes become a little bit impatient with people who go after religion as a whole or after Christianity as a whole on the basis of a very narrow subsection of it. And that's partly because I think religion is indelible and it's worth trying to bring out the best. But that's just, you know, I like all of them, and I pretty much, I think it's good to try and bring out the best. But that's my own. Anyway, that's fine. The point is that the religious side of South Africa is a nice place to look at how conservative we are, and how, unfortunately, because that fact is so smothered by those in charge, both in the halls of power and the corridors of media transmission, there isn't enough light to keep the best of conservatism going, and sometimes the worst of it takes over. And if I think about the church, it sickens me to consider how many national name brand Christian leaders effectively just sell a kind of materialist,
the prosperity gospel stuff,
and you'll get money. I find it obnoxious, and it's because where else can you find a national figure? What politician is going to say, you know what, if you work hard and you make lots of money, that's yours, no one else should have it? And it's not just nice, it's also good. No politician, not even in that awful DA, will politicians stand up and say, you know what, if you go and make money, in good business. It's a very, it's not just nice. It's actually very, very good. It's because it's too scary to say it. The Overton window is so far to the left. It is so anti-capitalist that if you go say capitalism has some virtues, you get hounded on. So the only people left to say it are the preachers, and damn it, it's the wrong place to be saying it. It just doesn't work.
You know, speaking of preachers saying funny things and promising material rewards for, you know, belonging and giving your money to the church, another facet of this conservatism, and it's one that's truly, I think, understood by both the ANC and the EFF. And this is why my mom is thinking about writing and telling about this, about the Moral Regeneration Project, which was originally headed by Jacob Zuma. But it's now sort of produced a report every year, and it's not clear if it's actually done anything, except it's signed a charter of moral regeneration twice. But that's for her to explain. But why does the ANC run initiatives like this? Why, when there was a preacher who was talking about everyone eating grass, do you remember that story? There was like a weird grass church. Yes, there was a weird church, and they said that the way to like be blessed by God was to eat grass. And there was another one which was you drink petrol, right? This was supposedly miracles of faith would protect you from these. The EFF went in, and I'm pretty sure they either harassed or burned down the church tent that was there. And that was a popular move, because a lot of South Africans have this sort of conservative thing of, this is unorthodox, this is profaning our sacred beliefs, these are people playing silly buggers with religion, and they must be punished for it. And the EFF and ANC do understand that it's one of the reasons they've managed to maintain such a grip on the country. And it's a problem that I think especially the DA has, is that, you know, it really doesn't, especially at its higher levels, quite get religion. It's sort of like, I don't know, it's like it's just a thing you have. No, it's not just a thing you have, it's an entire way of looking at the world. And it's core to people's identities, and it can't just be brushed aside or ignored.
It's deep, man. It's very deep, and it's very important, and it can be very admirable. But like all things, it has to be nurtured. It has to receive a kind of critical attention. It has to receive a kind of joyous grace. It's just no good relegating it to
You know, as has been said about many debates, is if responsible people don't have the conversations about these things, you're going to get fly-by-night people, charlatans, grifters, malevolent figures taking over the conversation. And because our commentariat and our elites are so disinterested in talking about, you know, this conservative parts of the country, religion, law and order stuff, we get people who go out there and call for vigilante action on a mass scale, not to defend property, but to hunt out and destroy the criminal elements. We get, you know, weird churches and people who are selling prosperity gospel, you know, discount Christianity. This is not what should be happening. I feel like if the Daily Maverick had interesting things, you know, about what was going on at the ZCC church, that would probably be pretty good for the country.
Dude, this has been such a long running theme of ours. And it is the kind of thing that makes me wish we had more resources to get the Daily Friend onto. And I mean, you know, I don't mind saying, like, our colleague Tieko, how do I say his surname?
Tsotse.
He, dude, there is an interesting young man. Hey, he tried running for a seat with a DA, sort of lost by a tiny little margin.
It was extremely split. I think like the winning party got some 21% of the vote, and the DA was in like third place with 18.5 or something. So
he lost by
Grahamstown,
like 48 votes for some whatever certain number it was. And so he came and worked with us a little bit, and it was so interesting hanging out with that guy, because part of him went, because he comes from rural nowhere, like as he tells the story, sort of hadn't met a white person until he finished high school, kind of thought that white people were all very
he hung out a lot with these kind of EFF academic-y types who were like always telling stories about the evil of white people, which were always never like a personal experience. It was always, you know, this happened to someone
mythological, but yes. he also obviously had a lot of good influences who were but you know, both in a sort of traditional healer, you know, ancestral, a religious space, which I don't really have the language to.
He's a devoted member of the ZCC Church, actually, and maybe we should get him on the show at some point to tell us about what's going on inside that church, because apparently it's quite complicated. There's some sort of leadership dispute at the moment.
Dude, it's mad complicated, and he's a mad complicated like thing going on in his own life, and it's like we live. It is so interesting. Like, if nothing else, there is something about chasing the stories that are interesting, that are just obviously fascinating, that should switch, that should be turning on the switches of South African readers and of South African writers or investigators. But something about that hasn't been happening. Something about it remains.
This is sort of this is exactly why I like the Daily Sun.
Yes,
dude. Because the Daily Sun, even though it's like a trashy tabloid, right? They would go out and they'd interview ordinary people about things that you weren't supposed to talk about. Mythology, witchcraft, weird sex stories, people with a strange family dynamics, tabloid stuff. But they weren't afraid to talk about the things that we're not supposed to talk about, that we never talk about. Like, what is it like to have... I think there was a story about a woman who's a polygamist and has four husbands, and then there's always a story about a tokolosh that's stolen something from someone or has caused some mischief somewhere. And these are interesting stories that I wouldn't say a majority of the country believe, but a lot of people take quite seriously and has an impact on their lives and the way they view the world. And these things are not sort of.
Especially in times of crisis, and to get back to the crisis right now, like we sort of started this. You asked me right at the beginning. You're like, what is there to be said about whether crime has just been hitting our TV screens more because the media has made a decision that this is now an important thing to focus on? And it's not just this week. It's like in this winter. One of the biggest stories is this criminal trial that's where the advocates have gotten involved and having allegations against themselves. Just on the average day when I walk downstairs where the TV's always on, more often than not, I'm seeing criminality being broadcast on SABC and ENCA. And that has never been the case before for such a sustained period. Sometimes you get a week or two, but this has pretty much been the whole winter, like the main, on the average day.
And the Tavern shootings, of course, as well.
Huge.
I made about the media not paying enough attention to it was prompted by a double murder in Limpopo, where a child had witnessed both of their parents, like a three-year-old, being hacked to death with a machete in front of their eyes in their hut. And it was in a very like rural small village in the middle of Limpopo. Just horrific, grisly scene from the short news story about it. It was like, kind of one of those stories that you barely even notice because it gets so little space on the webpage. And I just thought, how is this not a bigger story? This is horrifying. This is like the kind of story that should get, and the story was like, oh, no motive is known. There's like some rumor that it might be to do with a jealous lover or something. This is, how isn't this not being covered? And I'm so glad in a sense that conversation has changed. Sorry, I was interrupting you.
But dude, it has changed. And the Kestell Farm murders. I mean, the Kestell Farm murders have been covered for weeks. I've never seen that before. So... I think that part of it is a reflection of the general disgruntlement of the country kind of changing the media's focus, and it is kind of paying more attention to but I also suspect that the statistics might say that there really is a difference on the ground. That things really are getting worse. Winter is always cold and long and dry. It's very dry. And for people who live in close to the breadline, that live, it is worse. The cattle are leaner. And some of them die effectively of not
and when being you able have some to... Right. And when you have some bad load shedding on top of that, even the people with electricity are not, let's just say it's not something that puts you in the best of moods.
It's a time for desperation. It's a time for anger. I mean, just this week, a very dear and an intimate connection suffered an attack on his house, south of Soweto and Orange Farm. And then I just reflected on, like, his brother-in-law was murdered a few weeks ago. You know, it's like, it's very touching.
Got robbed recently.
Yeah.
Did you see that story? In a Cape Town restaurant.
Dude, it is not comfortable. It is not an exaggeration to say that it's not comfortable. Of course, where I am right now, I'm in a, you know, there's barbed wire there. There's two guards between me and the street. I walked two nights ago. I walked back from dinner, 10 o'clock at night, just walked home. It was very delightful. Last week, Friday, I had a Newsroom Africa interview at 10 past 10 at night. And before that, I went up the hill just to go have one beer because I was so grumpy that the thing kept being delayed. I was like, I'll break my rule. I'll have a beer before I do a TV interview. And I saw this like music thing and it was like this wonderful, super mixed, everyone's 20 years old and good looking and half the guys are wearing bathrobes and most of them have long hair and tattoos of all races. You know, it's like, look, we're all going to come together around the bathrobe, gentlemen. It's edgy. It makes you think about
bathrobe wearers of the world unite.
Makes you wonder what I'm wearing underneath, if anything at all. Come on, ladies or gentlemen or people of no gender at all. Here we go. Like, those kids were on another pluck and they weren't drinking too much. I felt so glad to be there and only a little bit embarrassed because it was false. I used to wear a bathrobe out to drinking parties when I was at university. I was that kind of the silly Billy. But I used to get much more embarrassingly drunk than these kids. They're like confident enough to like hang out with a drink or two and not get paralyzed. Very, very cool situation. And then walking home at 10 o'clock, come do the interview. You know, like walking blocks at night, seeing babies getting pushed around and prammed, not in gated communities. I do feel it amazes me how lucky I am to live where I live. But I've got to work and my work takes me around and I've got to visit people, including, you know, the family. And it's vivid to me that things are worse now than they were earlier in the year and that things are generally like not in a very desperate space. And I think that the worry is, one of the worries is that as South Africa tries to find its feet it's been knocked down so hard, you know, the real amazing thing about the anger is this fact that COVID is a fact about COVID. When COVID hit, I remember talking with you with great enthusiasm about the thought that we might now have a unifying idea after apartheid. Of like, okay, this was awful and we're dealing with this and it is awful. It's a common enemy and the bad issues can for years and years afterwards all get blamed on this and hana. Dude, that is not working. Guys, like those ANC chaps who try and say, COVID, dude, I'm not seeing that working. I'm increasingly seeing the unification of South Africans around the following idea. Politicians are wicked. When they're not useless. They're either like this whole thing of politics, it's just another way to eat the money. It is not working. Nothing that's supposed to work works. They steal, there's potholes, there's open sewerage in every little in the Free State, every town I've been to, there's a town and there's a township, and the sewerage next to the township has burst and has not been repaired. It's like if you walk around there, it just smells fetid. It's rancid. It's sickening. And there is a great anger against the conditions that we are in. And it's a kind of it's almost there, but it's not quite there. And we can easily make the mistake, either under the ANC or under some other dispensation of yes, getting more conservative, but doing so in a fashion that does not improve matters, because it does not the good sides of conservatism that are brought to bear. It is the worst sides of conservatism. It is the worst sides of xenophobic,
you know, antagonistic. For me, one of the key points of conservatism is a reluctance to do anything too extreme that might like destabilize things. And that's why I used the word reactionary earlier, because I think that's really, for me, the troubling thing about what this kind of conservative impulse that you're talking about has, is that it's not constrained by a sort of temperance or a moderate kind of view of life in the world, of saying maybe we should just slow things down a bit. It's saying no, we need to lash back. We need to lash back hard at all of these things that have tormented us for so long. An understandable emotion, but as you say, not very positive.
Yeah, I mean, so I would say that the thing being conserved by this vein of political flow, whatever it is,
anger.
I think the thing being conserved is the idea that you shouldn't distinguish between rules that are designed to work, even though the things that they govern and the things that need to make sure that they work are both imperfect human beings, and rules that are kind of designed to just benefit the powerful at the cost of the powerless. Like,
right.
That is that. There's a very, to my mind, very important moment that happens in societies again and again. If at all, and I think this is something you sort of said about Jonah Goldberg. Like, there's a kind of good side of society. It's where you really do need every generation to sort of wake up, do it its own way. But there's a sense of, like, ultimately, do you want to be ruled by a ruler? Are you looking for a ruler? Are you looking for a human being to step into some apex position of power to make everything okay? Is that what you're after? Or are you after rules that are robust and stand the best chance of upholding respect, a kind of mutual respect? And I think that there's a version of conservatism which is like a version of progressivism, where there are a lot of values that are kind of conservative. There's a lot of, like, stuff we don't want to change about society that we think is good. But what is the mechanism we want to achieve it? It is a hero. We are out for a hero who is a champion, a magnificent ruler. This ruler will make sure that we get what we
need. A hero.
And in the community, it's that guy who says, "We guys, come, let's go take out those zamazamas. He's our hero. He will tell us what to do, and if he's telling us to take."
Yeah, and this is core to human, I think, human psychology. This impulse for the hero, you know, every ancient mythological tale, even modern mythological tales, or political narratives, have the story of the hero who steps out of whatever he was doing before. He comes from outside. He comes from somewhere else, and he conquers all that stands before him and brings justice. I mean, you know, the kind of the cult of Trump is basically this idea, right?
Totally.
Is that, you know, you need the strong figure, the strong singular man who will order the universe as it should be. The Heracles, the Theseus, the Beowulf, who will come and free us all from the problems that have come. And I think in practice it tends to not work out so well, because heroes are mythical for a reason.
Or the preacher, the preacher who comes and promises you all the money and all the happiness, you know, and all the righteousness. We need to make the radical step towards thinking about better rules. Dude, this ENCA thing, I'm sorry I keep coming back to it, but it's like, I was there for an hour and a half, 2 hours, 20 people from all these political parties and whatever. to have a debate about policy. And the thing started with like, okay, we're going to have a debate about policy. It turns out South Africa's got great policies. They're just not being well implemented.
that cliche.
Other than me saying I want to change the rules so that instead of the government spending the money on education, it gives a voucher to parents and then they decide what school they want to. That is a change of the rules, which changes the power balance, which decentralizes it so that ordinary people have more power and central coordinators have less power. Other than that, nobody talked about any rules at all. They just talked about rulers. The youth said, we need to get rid of the aged and we need to rule the day. And some of the aged said, yes, that's a good idea, but you know, you should keep me around to be your advisor. And you know,
this party all the oldies said, except me.
exactly. And this party said, you know, we should be in charge. And that party said, we should be in charge. Dude, no one wants to talk about changing the rules. It is a very radical thing to change the rules. That is where we have to change things. I think if they're going to work, and I think that if we are not careful, like we can have five, we can the 2024 can be a hodgepodge, you know, either coalition of ANC and EFF or of opposition parties. You can have 5 years of messy, who knows what, and after that, a star can rise, a ruler, a hero, someone to bind the people together with the glue of great rhetoric and good feelings and selfies, and people can put their trust in a person rather than in a principle. And it is a devastating risk in this country where we have so much untapped potential for wickedness coming out of traditionally right-wing impulses. Like
exactly.
in the recent day, like the media, the guardians of truth and morality, they wouldn't know what smacked them on the nose because they've been so flippin' pent up about like AfriForum and Solidarity suing Julius Malema for singing Kill the Boer and sort of saying that you're violating, how culturally insensitive. Like these oaks, if there's a genuine kind of Le Front National of Marine Le Pen's father's nature kind of dungus in South Africa.
Yes.
I don't know that we have the resources. A lot of people would have to muster and realign to actually be able to to figure it out and do something useful about it. And maybe it seems like a quirky thing to flag, but dude, this is the thing about the summit.
I disagree completely with anyone who says that this is not quirky. This is a very real situation, and we're about to go, I think, through a period of profound political change. And even if there's an ANC EFF coalition to bolster the support that fairly shaky coalition is going to have, they're going to want to indulge in some of these impulses. And some of them, you know, like getting tough on criminals, like there's a certain thing that's very good about
yes,
that.
Yes,
but you can also do it very badly. I think that it's exactly right to flag that as a major potential problem for the future. And it's, you know, we've been so left-wing for such a long time that you can see a situation where, you know, we snap back to a kind of
we've been so the worst of the left wing.
Right, exactly.
We can be the worst of the...
that everyone who steals gets their hand cut off without trial, you know?
Yeah.
We're going to do whippings, and we're going to hang people for some kind of deviancy. It doesn't matter what
it is. Dude, and one of the things that I heard from the Rising Star, you know, at school, people are learning about insects. Why are they learning about insects? It's not useful. Dude, there's a very good point there. Our education system is letting people down. But you can get to the thing where, no. You must, at school, no one must learn. Never mind the debate around Shakespeare or Saul Plaikie's translation of Shakespeare, whatever.
Yeah, yeah. What are they doing learning about literature in the first place?
No. These peasants must work. They must learn how to go into the mines. They must learn how to do it. Must every
well,
person
something.
Has their role.
Yeah.
Yes. Dude, there is. I mean, and Mike Rowe, you know, what a wonderful guy. Anyway, so I think that there, you know, it's a tradition. It is. It just happens to be the case in the left-right split that the kinds of people who tend to say, you know, let's emphasize Tivet colleges, let's emphasize welding and plumbing as useful and admirable jobs, tend to fall on the right. And I think that they're right. I think that plumbers and welders are undervalued in South Africa. I think that we should be doing more.
And university degrees are overvalued.
But there is a way of doing this thing of overcompensating, of effectively squashing intellectualism, of celebrating illiteracy, of really once again, kind of to quote Rian Malan, to bring back the dopper. You know, in the Afrikaans churches, the most extreme conservatives back in the day, I think things have changed subsequently and are more interesting, was the dopper. And it means the candle snuff. And Rian's thought was that somewhere in the 1800s, some people just decided that the enlightenment of Europe with its idea of universal human rights and the values of sort of reading poems and men of feeling and respecting women and all this kind of stuff was just rubbish. Mm-hmm. And the enlightenment needed to be snuffed out by the candle snuff, by the dopper. And that is there is a through line to that political movement that transcends creed, class, and color. Mm. And it is something to behold. It's something to beware. And I think as we sit in the cold, dry, hard, long winter, it's actually something that you kind of have to block both eyes to even miss, because it's so obviously out there. People are killing each other.
And you can see it in the stats, right? So we do the survey of people on race relations, and we find that they're generally better than is kind of commonly perceived out there. But if you do the same surveys asking what people think about foreigners or what people think about gays and this kind of thing, you get a very different picture to what they think about race.
Yeah.
And therein lies, I think, the real potential for problems in the future.
Yeah.
The one that shocked me the most was that one I saw. I can't remember me for the life of it who did it. I think it might have been Ipsos or someone, but they asked people, you know, what's the main cause of unemployment in the country? And something like about 50% said foreigners.
Dude, it's mad. You know, I've been trying to help the Zimbabwean Immigration Federation. I got a phone call from this American journalist, and she said, da-da-da-da, and we started the interview, and I was like, hold on, you realize I'm not actually with the Zimbabwean Immigration Federation. I just kind of try to help them a little. We've got like an informal, I'm trying to, for the sake of the English language, I took a sentence they had that had 500 words, and I turned it into 12 sentences. Because there's a very passionate person who wrote this, who was very distressed. Right. And I just thought, let's make it readable. It's very important things that they're saying there. Some of the points I maybe disagree with. Some of the points are very good points, and I'm trying to emphasize those, etc.
Right.
And she said, no, you're with his you're not their spokesperson, but, you know, the chairperson said this and that. And we carried on. And then we kept having this back and forth. And I realized that she thought that I was – she was so convinced I was embedded in the ZEF that she thought I was saying I'm not the spokesperson. I'm actually the chair. I'm actually the president. And the chairperson is calling me the spokesperson to try and do a power play here to try and demean me. I was like, no, dude, I'm not at all involved. But look, I don't want to get into the legalese of this, but like, I do think it is it's a crying shame. It is a crying shame that instead of dealing with the real problem of a porous border, which needs proper policing, and of a generally lawless country that needs to sort of be brought into line step by step, you know, and there are practical solutions. Like instead of like having elected sheriffs, like we'd have, dude, if you had elected sheriffs in this country, it would be so blindingly obvious how conservative we are, because the sheriffs
But more than that, you know, just doing the basic things in the police force, like firing people who don't do their job, getting rid of the corrupt cops, following the rules that are already in place.
Yeah. But I do think my sense is that you probably have to change one or two rules in order to bring that about. And probably, I think the idea of electing a sheriff, or just electing someone whose job it is to go and fire police who don't do their job, basically.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah.
A community is what is a community actually? It's the kind of thing that should be able to elect someone who fires a cop who doesn't do his job. But you know, so like if you don't do that, which our government doesn't want to do, what else are you going to do? Well, you send this clear signal to society that if you get rid of 180,000 law-abiding Zimbabweans who got their visas under the special dispensation to do work here, if you get rid of them, things will be better. God damn it, man. I really.
This is like trying to battle underage drinking by raising the drinking age.
Yeah.
It's like, no. There are two problems here. One, the border is porous, and two, Zimbabwe is a basket case, and three, there's not enough jobs, right?
By the way, because of expropriation without compensation, and at the same time as trying to kick these guys out who are actually doing a job here, you're also trying to push expropriation without compensation through the expropriation bill. It's very, very upsetting, and I think that it's not obviously left wing. In the silly reductive way that maybe that doesn't matter very much, but in some level it's worth observing. Anyway, I think that we're good on time, eh?
Yeah, we are. So recommendations? Do you have any?
Can I go first? Because I kind of do have one.
Sure.
I want to recommend. There's so many. I really want to recommend. John Kane Berman's Between Two Fires. It's a wonderful book. I'd quite like to talk about it at some other stage when I feel a little bit less raw. So I'm going to not have that be the written thing. Instead, for the link, if you're looking for something to listen to, I recommend Lord Sumption's speech about what happens when an immovable force meets an unstoppable object. No, that's not it.
Immovable object meets an unstoppable force.
Thank you, Nick. It's been a long week. So Lord Sumption, who we've talked about quite a few times, he's sort of become famous for being a kind of lockdown skeptic in the UK. But we talked about him before the plague as a former Supreme Court Justice, Chief Justice of the United Kingdom, who has very interesting legal views that he speaks about quite openly. In this talk that I want to recommend, with the unstoppable force and the immovable object, or however you want to put it, he addresses the question of how to interpret the law within the EU and basically points to the fact that according to the EU's Supreme Court, the EU's laws and constitution are the supreme framework for interpretation. That is the highest law. And that court is the highest court. But according to at least half a dozen, by one count, a conservative count, but by a broader count, you know, almost every European country's constitutional courts or supreme courts, it's their own laws and their own courts that are supreme. And it's sort of like this wonderful paradox. And often it works, right? Because it's like, the EU says no, we are supreme, and the constitutional court says we are supreme. But the constitutional court's the local law says, you know, our law is that law, is the EU law. So there's no contradiction. When there's no contradiction in the particulars of the law, there's no tension in the fact that the two sources of law both claim supremacy. But when there is a contradiction on the particulars of the law, then it becomes a nightmare to figure out who actually comes first. And the German courts are the best because the German courts have said, no, we agree, Zolange one, Zolange wen, and Zolange wen one, Zolange one, and Zolange two. Is it like, no, we, the European court and the European Union, that's the highest law of all. As long as they adhere to like basic requirements of logic, it's the highest law of all. And then came the collapse of collapse of Greece.
As the holders of the imperial seat of the Second Holy Roman Empire, which is what the EU is, exactly. I'm not surprised that the Germans are kind of okay with letting its courts be aligned with theirs.
But wait. Then Greece is about to collapse, and the ECB says, okay, we need to spread the risk by creating these new bonds, and that'll sort of kick you to deal with the risk of a Greek default. And then the new case is brought to the German High Court, Supreme Court, Constitutional Court, and they say, no, look, guys, if you're going to start talking about the money.
Oh, then it's a different story. We can't let the Mediterranean people have their hands on the money.
The money is completely... The money, it is a German... The Germans will decide where their taxes are spent. And that is final. That is the beginning and the end of it. There is
the
no
EU is supreme in all cases except money.
Why? Literally... Because this is the core of our constitutional identity. and then the French, I kid you not, their constitutional court gave this ruling where they were like, well, when it comes to labor law, the EU courts are not supreme because this is the core of our constitutional identity.
Yeah,
this is, and then the Italians exactly... basically said, like, when it comes to pasta, never mind.
This is why I say that I like the EU in theory, but not in practice. because it is a protectionist racket filled with this silliness.
Dude, but and Lord Sumption is so proper and so English and so... And he just slips in the slyest little bits of wit in his sort of hour-long, otherwise, you know, quite dry and technical and whatever. But I think ultimately very interesting. Look, it's interesting from the perspective that he wanted the UK to stay in the EU. But is ultimately says, like, if you want to diss Brexit, you shouldn't do it by saying that there was no argument for it. Because in a way, Brexit was just another way of saying the same thing. Like, you can't let the European court and European law be supreme. And make, like, that's the framework within which the country exists.
And when they surveyed Brits who voted for Brexit, I think the largest share said that issue of supremacy was the thing that made up them.
That's the thing
that convinced me to go behind Brexit, by the way.
Yeah. I was a Remainer, but that was the thing that made me feel like I'm a Remainer because I'm afraid of World War III. But, like, logically speaking, I can see some arguments for the other side. Anyway, so it's an interesting thing because he's conflicted. Like, you know, he sort of wishes it all worked out, but he's sort of stuck with this logical impasse, and he describes it very nicely. Right. So there's a dispassionate and at the same time occasionally witty thing. So there we go.
Very good. I'm going to recommend a piece on National Review about the core ideology behind National Review magazine, and that is conservative fusionism, which is this idea that the only time that libertarians and conservatives are wrong is when they forget to emphasize the other one's key principle enough. So this kind of dichotomy between conservatives like virtue and libertarians like freedom, and the idea of fusionism is that coerced virtue is not virtue, and freedom without virtue is not really a proper freedom. Yeah, it's stupid.
Mm.
So the idea behind conservative fusionism is to say, how can we preserve a kind of moral character while at the same time enhancing human freedom? And this is the central idea behind National Review and most of its writing. And so the guy, Dan McLaughlin, in this article just goes a little bit into the people who kind of came up with the idea and some of its history and stuff, and why he thinks it's still a good thing, because there have been some people on the right who very strongly attacked fusionism, particularly the sort of so-called national conservatives or the NatCons, who are kind of flexing their muscles increasingly in the American right. You know, embracing Viktor Orban and championing the end of the free market dominance. And so this is basically a bit of a pushback.
Dude, someone needs to tell me when the free market dominated. Tell me when crony capitalism was overcome, because I
can't
know.
Yeah, I can't remember who it was. It was one of the key figures of the NatCons. who said that the real problem, I think it might have been even Tucker Carlson, who said something along the lines of, you know, the real problem with Washington is it's been run by libertarians for 30 years or something.
Some people are not thinking necessarily at all.
No.
While they speak. The lips are moving. There's lip movement. And it sounds like English. But a little bit of unthought.
Indeed. All right. And with that, yeah, we hope that you keep that fire, that flame of liberty, that flag of liberty flying, that flame of goodness burning within your hearts. And yeah, we'll see you next week.
Yeah, for the good. Grr, 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 grr.